Welcome to a new episode of Product Directions Podcast, 100 Product Strategies. We are your insider access to top product leaders shaping the strategy of the most diverse industries today. I'm your host, Nacho Bassino, and I'll be digging into the real-life situations, problems, and frameworks used for strategy with product people all around the world in all kinds of products and markets. While there is no recipe for success, listening to others' experiences may give you the edge you need to solve your next strategic challenge. Hello, everyone. I have the pleasure of being today with Randy Silver, and he is a product leadership coach and consultant, but also community builder, which I can attest because I'm part of one of his communities. But also I can say that he's very famous due to the Product Experience podcast, the hosting the Mind the Product podcast. And he's also author of a book, What Do We Do Now?, which is also a strategy book, but strategy in times of crisis. So it might be a different angle that we can explore a bit later then. Randy, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Nacho. It's great to be here.
Maybe to complete my intro, can you give us a bit more about your background and who you are and what you're doing?
Sure. So in a previous life, I was a music journalist, actually. I helped start Amazon's music store in the US and UK. And at a certain point, I realized that what I was doing was I was a better editor than a writer. And so what ended up working with writers and designers and developers and helping create something that was greater than the sum of the parts and targeted it delighting our customers. And at a certain point, I realized I didn't want to work in the music industry anymore, but this was a very fungible skill set. And to be honest, I think I pretty much do the same thing today. I work with people from different backgrounds and help them try and get the most out of bringing everything together and trying to figure out what is it that we're trying to do and how do we work together to do it. So that's kind of it. I spent a bunch of years in the US and then in the UK working in interactive things, worked with a bunch of large organizations. And for the past 5 years, I've been independent, consulting, doing interim roles, coaching, and now community building.
Okay, that's great. That's great. And maybe I should do a disclaimer of this episode because for the audience will be maybe a bit different because Randy will try to prove that strategy is worthless. Great topic for a strategy podcast. Let's make it spicy.
Yeah, not worthless exactly, but it doesn't matter how good your strategy is if other people aren't aligned to it, if you haven't sold it well. And there's a lot of things that go into making a strategy successful beyond having a good strategy by itself. And that's the part I wanted to talk about.
I love that. Maybe following the approach of this podcast, making it tangible, can you tell us the story that we should cover and maybe to make it different from other episodes, we'll start with kind of strategies complete. What's the strategy about? What we're trying to do? And maybe go into the story of trying to apply it and what failed in the process.
Yeah, I think the thing that makes me qualified to talk about this is how many times I've gotten it wrong and what I've finally learned from it. So in this particular case, my boss handed me, I was working for a very large company, and my boss handed me the worst system in the entire company. And I know it was the worst system, but there may have been ones that were potentially even more problematic, but none that were this problematic and had to be used by every single person in the company, because this was the one that you requested everything from, anything IT, anything permissions, anything else. And it was a system of audit that the entire company had to use. And it was a homebrew system. It had grown. It was built for one country and then decided to be reused and rolled out globally. And I can tell you, this is not something that our company was actually a core competency of our company. It's not something we should have been in the business of doing in the first place. And it was awful. Everybody hated it. And my boss kept getting yelled at by people in all around the world saying, when are you going to fix this crappy system? So he came to me and said, Randy, fix it. And I spent a few months looking at and doing a lot of business analysis and service design and mapping and trying to figure out what was going on. And finally got to the point of understanding what the problem was. We had problems with recruiting developers. We built it on a very particular type of technology. We weren't paying our devs for this very much, and it was very hard to recruit and get them. The system wasn't really designed for the job that it had grown to. And there were just any number of problems. So it wasn't much we could do. And I came up with a strategy of what to do. And there were a couple of different things. There was the technical side, which was we should replace it with an outsourced third-party SaaS system. And it was really obvious, and it was the right thing to do. And it would take me, I think it was about $8 million to do it and about 3 years to pull it off. But I also, just from one use case alone, found savings of $20 million within 18 months. I said, okay, this is a winner. This is going to be great. And pitched it up the line, and people kept going for it. And finally, I went to the person who would be funding it, which was the right-hand man of the global CTO. And he went through the whole thing, and he said, right, so I have to pay you $8 million to do this. How much benefit do I get from this? And it wasn't $8 million. His budget wasn't going to break even on this. And I thought it was something that was, you know, he would be looking out for the balance sheet of the business as a whole, and that we could sell it as a win across the board. But instead, he actually was essentially running his own insourced business, and he had needed to appear profitable. So it was good for the business as a whole, but not for his business line specifically. So he turned it down. And I left the company shortly after because even though it was the right strategy and it was a really good thing to do, and subsequently other people did sell this internally and go through it, and it did get implemented. It took another 5 years, and I'm just not that patient a person. But they had to go back and write more business cases and find the right way and find the right allies and find a way to actually sell this internally. So it was a massive win. Everyone could see that it was a massive win. It just wasn't the right win for this person, and we had it mapped out their specific motivation. And it was a huge lesson to learn something that's obvious and right, but also not obvious and right for that person.
That's super interesting. Because this is a very extreme example for sure. But on the other hand, if you think about the constraint in more in an abstract perspective, it's all about kind of fulfilling the needs of the different stakeholders. So you may have, for example, a more typical one is, hey, I have this great idea, but legal will not go through it. And you need to kind of find a way to shape it and to account for it. Did you at that point in time, do you remember attempting kind of different angles? So I can imagine kind of typical escalation or working with the peers or something like that. So what are some paths that can be interesting to explore in that situation?
Oh yeah, so we had done other things first. That was the winning strategy they had gotten everyone else on, and gotten up essentially to the global CTO or the right hand man anyway. And you know, I thought that by that point it was a done deal. Everyone else had signed off and had seen the good. It was no one had seen the very obvious problem or pointed out to me either. So yeah, there were any number of other things that we tried. I allied with the HR team who wanted to use the same third-party system. So getting the vendor into the company in the first place was going to be hard enough. Uh-huh. But if it was now just saying, okay, well, HR is using it, so we should use a different module from those people, that was going to be a lot easier. And I allied it to that part of the strategy. I found a number of other things. I really thought, you know, I had done this for a while. I had made plenty of mistakes before. One of the other problems with it was I had solved some of the problems around the user experience. So people weren't yelling about it quite as much either. It was still a terrible system. All I did was put something on the front that said, we served 10,000, you know, 30 to 50 to 100,000, I can't remember how many requests per month, and said we actually served this many requests successfully. And our SLA, we met something like 94% within SLA. So the perception of the system was now, no matter how bad it actually still was to use, people realized that it wasn't nearly as bad as they thought. So it wasn't as much of a problem for them. It wasn't as important to solve. And actually, that's a massive thing that I think hits most product managers at one point or another, is the perception of the problem.
Yeah.
So if I'm the product manager for feature X, that is what I spend all my time working on. I care about that so much. And I can see that if we improve something in feature X land, I can make us another $5 million a year. And my God, that pays for my team well beyond, you know, a huge recoup on my team. It's an obvious thing that we definitely need to do. The problem is my entire viewpoint is focused on through the lens of feature X. And I don't know that feature X isn't the most important thing in the company right now. And maybe feature A or a different client profile is something that's got a $100 million opportunity. Yeah. But they're on the other side of the organization. I'm not hearing about them all day, every day. I don't have the same perspective as my boss has, and my boss hasn't necessarily shared it with me, or maybe it's two or three levels above me that information is. So perspective and understanding other people's motivations is incredibly important. And that's really a key thing of making sure your strategy is actually the right strategy for what's needed right now.
Yeah. I think that you said two important things in there. The first one is when you think about perception, I think kind of one of these initial works of doing strategy is kind of gathering the insights, understanding what's the real problem here, what is the real challenge to solve. And it sounds like what you found out is like, hey, this problem is not as hard as it might sound, or the voices are telling us. So we need to kind of really dig deep. And I think that the solution of changing the perception is a very good solution because it's also cheap. So it's also a good strategy. And the second thing that you said, I think it's interesting, is that if you are not, so let's say you go to your boss and say, hey, dear boss, this problem is not as big as it seems to be. He's the one who needs to give you the strategic context to say, hey, okay, Randy, now go solve another problem or change the route. So it's quite problematic for product managers or even for product leaders, kind of in a very big organization with multiple layers, if they are not getting the decision context to make these better decisions, if it's not important. So it's an interesting learning.
Yeah, it's something I see over and over and over again. Everyone is operating with the best intent. Everyone is trying really hard, but there's so much information out there and we're so overloaded with meetings and there's so much going on that we just can't see everything. It's a problem at the highest levels. And, Brian Chesky from Airbnb did a talk recently at the Figma conference where he talked about killing product management or making them all product marketing managers. And what I took it away from it was something different, is that he didn't see from his perspective what all the low-level strategies were that people had. And it was a failure of articulating what was the most important to the business and giving them something to all align to. He talked about everything being in silos and being in bits and pieces. And that's why he's reorganized it around North Stars and making big bets and very specific bets and limiting what they're actually working on. Probably something that was needed earlier on for them. I mean, incredibly successful company. I don't want to tell them how to run it, but based on what he's saying, there were missed opportunities. But yeah, it's a really hard thing to see what's going on from the top, but also incredibly hard to see what's going on from the bottom.
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe to explore something X about this story, I'm curious about how you get to this solution, because I mean, of course, it sounds very obvious that now that you see it, but so I assume in the selection process, for example, you may have already homegrown super weird use cases that maybe not all software services will cover, or you may have to streamline how you do things in order to fit the software service. So maybe in this strategy creation process, or before jumping to the no-code decision, were there any bits of how you collected the insights or how you selected some of these tools?
Yeah, absolutely. So like I said, we started off working with a couple other people and really understanding the system as it was, and understanding the volume of requests that were coming in, the type of requests, what we were able to handle well, what we weren't able to handle well, and how long it was going to take us to fulfill even the requests that we had, let alone the stuff that we knew was coming in the future. And there was just no way we could do it. What we had built was not fit for the purpose that the system had grown into. That's not to say that the system was a failure. It went from nothing to handling a lot. it just was had outlived what it could do, and the demands now being put on it. It wasn't designed badly; it just couldn't do what the company now needed it to do. So we put together a classic project management strategy document called a Clear Choice. And those always have one column of do nothing. What happens if we do nothing? What happens if we invest in the current system? What happens if we retire at all? And what are the vendor alternatives or other ways of building this? And so we looked through all of those things and we spent time forecasting out and saying, realistically, this is the scenario for each of them. And it was when we put it down on paper like that, that it became incredibly obvious that the organization had specific regulatory needs. There were companies out there that were good at that. And going from something that was a very difficult platform to code on to something where we could hire people, not off the street, but people that we could train really quickly and use a very basic editor to create a lot of these things that we might be able to enforce rules and give the power back to individual business units to create some of these requests and things rather than outsource everything or insource everything to a specific management team and dev team. There was just so much more that we could do. And it took us months to get through all of this, to working both with the team that was doing the development there and the management team or the engineering management around it, but also with our stakeholders, the ones who were angry at us because we weren't developing fast enough and saying, right, is this something that works better? What is it that you actually need? Do you need us to just roll out more rules or do you need something that's going to be 10x improvement? And how would you engage with something like this? And they were very enthusiastic about it. Working internal, because this was something that enabled the organization to be in regulatory compliance, that we worked with the internal regulatory specialists and compliance specialists so that they could say, yes, this is the kind of thing that we need. And just on and on, we went through everybody to make sure that we had the internal allies to say, this was the right thing. The last bit was making sure that the internal funding model actually worked.
Yeah, very interesting. So I'm not sure if there is another learning, because basically my conclusion is, hey, the strategy was good. The decision-making process was good. We just needed a bit more time to process and find other ways to fund it, because it seems like they implemented in the future. If you have to tell Randy let's say that you come back from the future and say you are starting the project again, will you do it the same way, or is there any learning that you will do differently?
I certainly would have made sure that I had taken into account the CTO's funding model and making sure that I had pitched it in terms that made sense to them. The other one's an interesting one. Because, like I said, I did a bunch of work on changing the perception of the system by how I worked with stakeholders, the conversations and forums I put together with them that ameliorated them so that they weren't as angry with my boss anymore. They didn't see this as a burning platform anymore. And the UI changes that contribute to that as well. Those were tricks. They were things that were useful. They didn't actually solve the underlying problem. And I'm still not sure what I would do. I think it's situational because doing that can really help. If I was customer facing, I would external customer facing in this, I probably would do that because it would improve perception, improve profitability for us. It would probably get rid of churn. But because it was an internal tool, maybe in the future I wouldn't make those specific improvements so that I'd have more people shouting at the CTO to fund me as well. And I might have played the political game slightly smarter.
Sounds like a duty trick, but let's go.
I'm not sure. I've thought about it both ways because it does feel a little bit dirty. I'm not making an improvement to make sure that something gets done. On the other hand, all I did was hide the problem, and it was still a very big problem. And because it was compliance related and the system couldn't handle it, All I did was make it so that people weren't yelling about it, but I hadn't actually gotten rid of the underlying problem. If it was just a nice to have, then I definitely, then it's not that important. But because it was compliance related, I think anything I could do show people how important this was might have been not a dirty trick, but a positive trick.
Okay. Fair enough. So maybe I know that there is another story and I want to make sure I have time to cover that. So do you want to search trucks and tell us another story where a strategy was good but did fail?
Sure. So yeah, I was working with, in this case, with a B2B business in a very niche industry. And we wanted to build out on our success. And we had done something that did a small part of our customer's process, and we wanted to go end to end. And it involved being in financial services, going from just onboarding people to actually going all the way through the process and doing payroll as well. And because it was a niche industry, it was incredibly complicated. There's lots of rules. And again, we needed to be compliant with all of the rules. And this is not one of those things, unfortunately, or at least I've never figured out how you can be agile and iterative in terms of something like this. Because in terms of payments, you're either making the payment or you're not. And anything short of making the payment is not something that adds value to the customer. So we couldn't really go end to end. We could go thin slice, though, and say we will only do it in certain circumstances, certain very narrow tranche of customers. So that's what I was pushing for, and prove that we could go that end to end and then continue to build out and add more customer types, add more scenarios, and go from there. The problem is that's what made sense to us. That's what we could actually build and accomplish. It's not what our company wanted, or at least the larger parent company that we were working with. They worked with very large organizations who wanted an all singing, all dancing system and couldn't accept that it would take us this long or it was this hard to do it. After all, they had done it in different territories. They had done it in different ways. And we never really settled on what we needed to do, or at least not in time. It took us much longer than we wanted to, because there were versions of this where we went very niche and went automated end to end. There were versions where we went wider, but we didn't do it all automated, that we did manual services for part of it until we got up and running. And then, you know, the idea of build something that doesn't scale, then scale it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we could have done it by partnering with other people or bringing people in temporarily to do parts of it manually and then work on automating those over time. But we had too many contradictory things. We knew what the right strategy was. We knew we wanted to build this. We knew we had the right entry to the customers. But the strategy of getting from A to B to C to D was something that was very inconsistent internally. So while we knew where we wanted to go as a business, the strategy for achieving it was not something that was agreed on. And it ended up being an absolute mess. It just took us way longer than it should have. It caused way more problems. We lost a number of good people because they just got frustrated and burnt out. And they were people who absolutely could have helped us succeed. In the end, the parent company finally saw what was going on and did acquire a number of other companies, players that would help us, would have helped early on, that we could have partnered with early on to do manual bits while the whole thing was built out. But it just took way longer than it should have.
Interesting. So I have a couple of questions. The first one is, when you say versions of this, you're referring to versions of the plan. So you were changing the plan.
So, you know, there was always an assumption that something would probably be easy or that a vendor would work. We didn't do a good job on riskiest assumption tests. Okay. We knew that certain things would be hard, but we said, we've done other things before. Give us a couple of months and we'll nail that down. And between things being harder, partners not coming through as well, turnover on our team, so we didn't have the developers or the product managers available with the expertise to really do it. We were constantly onboarding new people. We just never got where we needed to be on some of these things. So we were always falling behind.
Okay, got it. But maybe going back to the niching down scaling, you said, for example, that kind of the time it would take to have let's call it the vision, the final vision ready, it was unacceptable. So was there a path to get there faster? So was you frame it as a problem of selecting the strategy, so selecting where to jump from one time to another, but was there a kind of so the expectation was logical, or was just kind of pure irrational decision making?
No, it was very logical. Both sides in this case, and there were probably more than two sides, to be honest, but let's go with the two easy ones. They were both absolutely right from their perspective. One team, the side that I was on ultimately, said, this is what is possible. Mm-hmm. You know, we can only do small customers at first. Customers who fit in very specific scenarios, and let's prove it with them and win some trust, and now give us the time to build more things and be able to do more. That made a lot of sense. From the other side, from the parent company side, they were not interested in those customers.
Yeah.
That's not who they worked with. That's not who they were working on very large contract renewals with. So they needed to prove something that they could satisfy a customer at scale quickly. And the two things, unfortunately, were incompatible. And even though we did talk about this, and we talked about this in a very friendly and open way, it was never properly resolved. Both sides walked away from the discussions thinking that their strategy was the one that we would pursue. Okay. And so the team kept working on it, and no one was ever happy.
That's very interesting. I see how. So, on one hand, I will say that this was not a successful strategy because it failed to consider one constraint of the business. So, say, mm-hmm. Hey, we need to focus on these big customers. On the other hand, I also hear what you're saying. Hey, the company, the smaller company, or the subsidiary. I'm sure, what's the legal mm-hmm. term here? Was empowered somehow to run with the strategy, so they have a strategy that they could make work, just that was not satisfying to the stakeholders.
It's a tough thing, because we were given too many constraints. We were given a constraint of do it quickly, do it big, and do it automated, and we couldn't do all three of those things at once. We could have done it quickly, and we potentially could have done it big had we partnered. But there was no way of also automating it in any reasonable time frame. That's unfortunately, like I said, payment space with a complicated regulatory environment. It just takes time. There's a reason we didn't have many competitors in the space.
Yeah, interesting. And maybe to make this more tangible for product managers and product leaders out there facing this situation, how to challenge it. So you are basically handle unreasonable expectations or unreasonable goals by your management, but you are forced to come up with a strategy. What will you do?
You know, it was a funny one because there was a time where the CEO of the parent company came over to visit us, and we were trying to talk about the trade-offs that were needed for this. And he leaned across the table and said to us, "The problem with you guys is that you're an or company. You're saying that you can do this or that. Us, we're an and company. We'll do this and that." And he just wasn't acknowledging the constraints. And we said, okay, well, if that's the case, we're going to need a hell of a lot more resource, a lot more people, or a different way of doing it. And that wasn't forthcoming either. Ultimately, it comes down to communication and trust. And if you can have good communication and trust, then that's something you can influence. And like I said, ultimately they did go ahead, somebody who was close enough to the CEO who had their trust already, got involved in it and said, right, to make this work, we're going to have to acquire some other firms that do pieces of this. They may do it manually, but now it'll all be under umbrella and we'll be able to service those large accounts the way you want. But it took a long time and a lot of experimentation and a lot of failure for that to become sink in and become the reality. If you're in that case, yes, if you can find the right ally and convince them and let them make the case for you, that's an ideal thing. The other is either put your head down and say, right, I'll wait and we'll see what happens, or say, you know what, this this isn't for me. This is not the place for me. And so neither of those things is wrong. It depends on your personal situation, your tolerance. Can you afford to find another job? Is another job forthcoming? Do you really like being in this position? Is it worth waiting a while? For me, I was a consultant. I was on an interim contract in that place. So I had a specific shelf life and it was always going to end. And I regret that we weren't able to get further and I wasn't able to communicate and convince some of that. But again, I was interim. I didn't have the deeper relationships and I wasn't able to do some of that.
Yeah. No, it's interesting because what I'm reflecting on is that I'm always big on evidence-based, so evidence-based discussion. So it's my shortcoming because I haven't seen this sort of, or haven't had this sort of CEOs yet. But ultimately what I'm going to say is that if you have strong evidence, no one will shy away from deciding based on evidence. But in this situation, looks different because on the other opposite side, what may happen is that let's go for a different extreme. If they have trust on someone who is advising incorrectly, they will also follow this based on trust and the ill advice. So it's super tricky.
The best boss I've ever seen on this, the best executive I've ever seen on this was many years ago. I was working for Sirius Satellite Radio in the States, and we had deals with lots of the sports leagues. And this is when Yahoo and ESPN were first getting into fantasy sports and doing it in a big way. And there was a decision that we should get into that space as well, that there was a real opportunity. We had deals with the leagues. We had lots of sports channels. It was something that we absolutely could have done. And a small task force, about five of us, were put together to put together a proposal around it. And we looked at it, and I remember my specific strategy was, we can't build this. That's not our core competency. There's no one else that we could buy it from right now. So we should partner with one of the existing vendors in this space and do something. That wasn't the mission we were given. There were other people who said, we absolutely need to go for it. So we sat down with our sponsor. Let me say it that way. Our executive sponsor for the project. And he took a look at what we had done. And the proposal was that the team had come up with, the majority of the team had come up with, was let's build it. And he looked at the numbers, he listened to the argument, and he said, well, guys, I got to tell you, I'm not seeing it. You haven't convinced me. But if you really believe this is the thing to do, I could be wrong. So tell me, do you feel that strongly that this is what we should do? And none of them were willing to risk their jobs on it. Essentially, that's when they said, yeah, we could do it, but I don't, my level of confidence isn't high enough for you to put your reputation on the line for us. And it died because of that. And it was absolutely the right decision. We should not have done it. And I'm really glad we didn't do it. But he did it in such a nice way of basically challenging everyone to show their confidence in being able to do the mission and saying, I have your backs no matter what. Yeah. But, you know, you make this decision, you own it.
Yeah. No, I think that goes in the same direction because at the end of the day, you are putting the executive in a tough position because either they kind of, let's call it this way, please you with your low level of confidence saying, okay, if you feel like going with it, or he makes what he believes to be the right decision for the company, given his confidence that it's also super opinionated. That's why, for example, I love Itamar Gilad, the confidence matter, because he tries to put confidence into more kind of concrete terms. Say, hey, our level of confidence is high or low based on these very concrete facts, and that's much more healthy.
I like to partner that at the more team level with something that Liz Keogh does around estimating complexity. It works really well, and the idea is there's a 5-point scale, one is everyone on the team has done this. We know exactly how long it'll take. Two is someone on the team has done this, but we're going to train up someone else. So we we have an idea of how long it'll take. Might, you know, 1 to 2x maybe at most, but someone on the team can partner. 3, someone else in the company has done this. So, you know, we know it's possible. We can potentially get them to help us out if we need to. So 3 times as long. 4 times as long is someone in another company has done this. We know it's theoretically possible. We just don't know if it's possible here. And 5 is no one has ever done this before. This is a brand new thing. And it's a fantastic way of, because, you know, the most dangerous word for any strategy is the word just. Can't you just do this? And when you then explain, you know, okay, yes, but it's a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 on Liz Keogh's scale. And then that factors into Itamar's confidence estimate in a big way. And it's a fantastic way of pulling it all together.
Very interesting. Nice. All right. Let me think about more question about this one. So maybe going back to the insights related to, or not even to the insights, but how do you select? And we talk in 2 cases now about buy or build decisions. So in this second case, which the build situation was much stronger, how do you go about making a strategy to decide on those 2 fronts, which are kind of radically different in terms of strategy creation?
I think it really comes down to, is this the core competency of your company? Is this the distinguishing factor? How are you going to build a defensible moat for your strategy so that competitors can't just copy and go past you really quickly? If you buy as a key part of your strategy, or build on top of someone else, well, first you have to have an incredible level of trust in your vendors and partners. You know, you look at all the companies that built on Twitter right now; they're not happy. You know, but similarly, if I build something that clutches together other stuff, what's to stop someone else from doing the exact same thing? So I'd better have a secret sauce. If it's not my core company, so like with the large organization, the first story I told, that internal system was not part of our core competency. It was not something that was customer facing. It was just an internal requirement. And while it would be expensive to spend the money, we showed that it was cheaper than doing it ourselves, but it was a hard thing to show. So it's figuring out, is this something that we should be spending time on that's going to help us make more money? That is something we really need to do that makes us better than our competitors. Otherwise, you should look for opportunities to buy or rent anytime you can for those types of things. At a certain point, you know, if the buy or rent decision is really expensive or difficult and you see an opportunity and you're going for operational efficiency rather than growth, then maybe you do want to build your own stuff sometimes, but you need to be really clear as to what is it you're trying to do. Do you need all the bells and whistles and extra features? Do you need regulatory compliance, things like that? But yeah, there's definitely places you can homebrew and build things where it makes sense.
Yeah. And I think that one thing is a bit more nuanced than kind of just either or is, for example, the payment example you were mentioning before. You know that you're kind of that system was part of your core value proposition. But on one hand, you have some differentiations that were not automation. So if you can kind of rent, at least temporarily, the automation can speed you up to deliver the value, to build the strength that you want to build. And eventually you can automate that other part.
So what stage are you in the product lifecycle? And what's the most important metric for success? Is it acquiring users or is it operational efficiency? Is it cost or volume? Make your decisions based on what you're trying to do at that point. And it may change over time. It's okay to start off buying and renting things. It makes a lot of sense if you're not 100% sure if something's going to work or scale. But make sure that it's a two-way door, that it's something you can take your information out of, that you can build, retire it and transfer at some point.
Yeah. Maybe it's a good time to ask you my typical closing question, which is, What is some learning about strategy that we haven't covered so far? Some interesting learning you have around this interesting journey of many, many battles that you have under your belt.
I think really comes down to perspective more than anything else. I've gone through, and again, I've made this mistake so many times, and I've seen it happen with people I coach all the time. Most of the time, the problem that comes down with strategy isn't that someone else disagrees with you. It isn't that you stick with it too long and aren't evidence-based or things like that. It's really a matter of perspective. It's a matter of not saying I've got strong opinions weakly held. It's a problem of not being willing to be convinced. Because you can walk into the room, virtual or real room, with as much information as you have. But if someone else gives you different information, or you find out that their perspective lacks some of the information that you have, then it becomes about how do you work together. And one of the things I've seen happen again and again and again is that we say evidence-based, and evidence-based means that you're willing to accept facts and that you're willing to be convinced. And there are times when people take this the wrong way. And then emotion comes in, and emotion is really tricky because you can't defeat emotion with facts or with rational conversation. So understanding motivations, giving people ways to save face, making a campaign so that people understand in a gentle way that you're all working together this on the same thing, that you're willing to be convinced, that make sure that they're willing to be convinced. Make it not a me against you thing where I'm trying to convince you of my strategy, but a way that we are constructively working together on the best way possible to satisfy the ultimate stakeholders' needs and hit the goals of the company. It's really more about storytelling and collaboration. Mm. So much more. And you know, the business side of strategy is incredibly hard. But the getting everyone to work together to do it is harder again. And that's the part I would love to see people spend more time on as well.
Yeah, I love how, because you may have the facts, and what you do with the storytelling is kind of change the emotions based on the facts you have. So it's super.
But you need to have them both in concert, because just otherwise you're a cult leader. You're telling people a really great story and you're taking them on a campaign, but it's a faulty one. Sure that it's defensible, that it's evidence-based, that you're checking and rechecking your assumptions, that you're checking in on a regular basis, because things change. So it's all the things that you normally talk about with strategy, but also collaboration and storytelling on top of it.
Yeah. You mentioned cult leader in this context, and for a second I thought about WeWork. I don't want to go with that rabbit hole, but... All right, Randy, this has been amazing. Thanks so much for sharing all those tips. Where can people find you, find your work, connect with you?
Sure. So you can find everything from me at outofowls.com. That's my business name, Out of Owls. Or you can hear me on another podcast with Lily Smith called The Product Experience, where we talk to great people like Nacho about how they do their job.
Highly recommended. Okay, thanks so much, and have a nice rest of the week.
Thank you, you too.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of 100 Product Strategies, the podcast by Product Direction. You can also follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, or Instagram to get access to free weekly content that helps product people upgrade their skills and become more successful. You can access more material, promotional trainings, and be notified of every episode of the show with Product Direction's weekly newsletter. Join thousands of product leaders by registering in productdirection.co.